worries whether it have its capacity and resources to do that. And we also would like to hear, you know, the views of our guests about the possible development they thought. So that these four areas we suggest to our panelists today. It doesn't mean we need to follow the sequence, but we think if in order to have this kind of conversation to be carried on in a more effective way, then probably we need to, you know, throw some issues up front. And now I would like to talk about a little bit of time management thing, because during the last 2 days conference, I found the time management becomes very crucial in order for everyone to get meals on time, you know, cash plan online. It's very important. So today the two professors need to leave for the airport, and so we definitely need to end our session by 11. And so when you want to raise questions, please raise your question quickly in a more efficient way, so we can have, you know, more people, you know, talk and share their view. And so I don't think I need to continue the, my introduction. Just let us welcome them again, and then I will turn the microphone to them.
You have a text,
so you first.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me here. This is a Singapore habit. When in doubt, you write everything down that you're going to say. Make sure you say it. When I got the email from the university, I was very puzzled because the email only said, you know, we want to talk about the run-up to Hong Kong, to the Hong Kong Exchange this year. So I immediately panicked. I thought, you know, I'm not a frontline negotiator. I've just returned from the government. I've just gone back into university, so I quickly called up some friends. So I bribed them, took them out for dinner. This is what they had to say. Then I put together this piece of paper, which I'm going to relate to. What it is an impression of how we see the state of global negotiations from a Singapore. Or more precisely, it's my impression of the impression of my colleagues. That's my backdrop. Okay. It gives me a little bit of room to say, if you quote me on this, oh no. That's just my impression of their impression. But as you know, we are very pro-trade, because basically that's how our economy operates. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a very quick background of where we are today, and then to give you our impressions of what we see. For us, Doha in 2001 was the peak. Expectations were big. Cancun was the ultimate letdown. There has been a lot that's been said about why Cancun was a failure. And I know that my colleague who's not here, a Malaysian, a former Malaysian ambassador, Subramaniam, is very, very irritated by this suggestion that the developing countries are to blame. We think there are several factors, including the G20 and G90 groupings. We do see an element of developing countries playing to the gallery. The way we put it to ourselves, to console ourselves in Singapore, is to say that we are witnessing the UNization of the WTO. The WTO is becoming like the United Nations, playing to the gallery, a lot of rhetoric. But of course there are substantive issues as well. We're looking at cost and subsidy, agriculture. Of course Singapore played a role in the agriculture negotiations, primarily because we have no agriculture. But notwithstanding the free Cancun EU-US joint paper, we felt that the G20 were more prepared to make demands than they were prepared to give anything. In fact, for us, the G20 seems to us like a repackaging of the old like-minded group. It's just a change of labels. Also the G33, a special products group. So what caused the outcome in Cancun? And this is what startled me when I started talking to colleagues. Singaporeans are very management-oriented in their analysis. And one of the analysis I came across that I was fascinated with was that the chair had mishandled the negotiation. This wasn't simply a case of, you know, play the man, not the ball. It was a genuine belief that there was a sequencing problem in the negotiations. The Mexican chair, the question we asked ourselves is, was it correct for the Mexican chair to conclude the session at the time he concluded the session? Was it right for him, in terms of sequencing, to have started with the Singapore issues, trade facilitation, investment, competition policy, and transparency? His thinking was that there was no longer scope for compromise, and therefore the session should be concluded and we can't move on. But Singapore policymakers generally felt that we should have moved on to agriculture nonetheless. Of course, this may or may not be due to the fact that my colleagues were just being supportive of the fact that our minister was very much involved as a facilitator for the agriculture negotiations, Minister George Yeo, but he had worked out compromise language with India on the side on rural and subsistence farming, which was acceptable, we felt, to India, but this compromise was not floated for discussion at all in the Green Group. Some of the officials in Singapore believe that the G22 could have accepted that compromise if the papers were serviced. I don't know if they were just being overly optimistic or betting for the whole team. But anyway, the impression is that the G20 became emotive, the African countries took up the cotton issue, and at the end of the day, the European Union and the United States were not ready. Some other people felt that, and this is to state the obvious, if the G90 had accepted the Singapore issues, we would have moved on to agriculture. But that's a minority opinion. And it's not a very constructive opinion. The EU was pushing, however, for a trade-off between the Singapore issues and agriculture. But we felt that if the EU had conceded on their own ambitions on the Singapore issues, then likewise they could have lowered their ambitions about what they could offer in relation to agriculture. We felt that the negotiations were pitched too high. That was one possibility. But of course, the G20 countries considered that would not be enough. Anyway, we now have a setback, and at the end of the day, much depends on where the European Union and the United States want to go with this. After Cancun, Pascal Lamy gave a push by outreaching to Africa, Latin America, India, and Brazil. This was essentially a European Union idea. Likewise, Zelic came to Singapore for a meeting with ASEAN trade ministers. ASEAN met Lamy, and so this was the culmination of EU-US and US outreaching together. It was Zelic who came up with the idea that another ministerial would raise expectations too high again. We needed to find a middle way. So Zelic came up with this idea of going halfway with a special session at Geneva. We called it a one-half instead of a full-blown ministerial. And this was supported by all ASEAN countries at the Singapore meeting. So the idea was if ministers wanted to go through, that was fine. And that was what led to the July Special General Council. In fact, the basis in textual terms for the Special General Council was, we think that the best text in Cancun itself, because it was recycling an old text, but in any case, about 30-odd ministers attended. We now see a new group. I think this was mentioned during the three-day conference at National Taiwan University last couple of days. We now see a new group emerging. We call them the five interested parties, the US, EU, India, Brazil, and Australia. India and Brazil, because they are from the G20, Australia from the Cairns group. But we have many of the other agriculture-oriented people who are not happy. Nonetheless, the five interested parties came up with a compromise on agriculture based on the best text. And the EU, we think, has in effect reiterated the same offer it has made previously. Of all the Singapore issues, there's only one that remains on the table, and that's trade facilitation. All the others are out. But we think this is a good thing. The July package, we believe, has that was very important to them, to keep the momentum going. I think someone said this as well in the last couple of days, that I think it's Professor Matsushita, that you basically have to keep paddling, and you will get there at some point. We think the Africans have also become less confrontational, and they sense that they overplayed their hand at Cancun. Pending the departure of Zelic and Lamy, of course, people also felt compelled to say positive things about the July package. I think these elements count in the negotiations. So that's the background to the decision to have the Hong Kong meeting with ministerial at the end of this year as a target, and this is reflected in the July package, simply because we need new direction now. We've missed our previous deadline. We need to keep hammering on, and we need to knock out the numbers. We need to talk details. So that's roughly where we are today. Now it's a question of, even amongst ourselves, having the more optimistic officials talking to the less optimistic officials. Generally, even in headquarters in Singapore, our own perception of our mission in Geneva is that those people are all doom and gloom. You know, they only send back their very negative impressions. They don't believe that anything can happen. And it's more a matter of headquarters keeping up the morale of the Geneva mission. But after July, we have a roadmap to reach Hong Kong. And by the end of this month, the members are, in theory, in principle, required to have a close approximation, some details on the territory. So, best case scenario, what are we hoping out of Hong Kong? We want to see modalities for one simple reason. We want negotiations to start early next year. That's a best case scenario. The current reading, however, is that nothing is going to happen this month. And some people, some of the usual optimists, are even beginning to tone down, tune down their expectations. We'll be very careful. What are the other factors? Well, change of USTR, change of EU trade representatives. We have a sense that this is not something that we like, that the European Union seems to be moving back. They seem to be moving forward and then moving backwards again. This may be because of their current constitutional and political crisis. Their attention is elsewhere, and it has had an impact on the maneuverability and acceptability of the European Union. On the part of the United States, we also sense increased protectionist tendencies. I think that even in the Taipei newspapers, I noticed that yesterday the papers were talking about a pending global war on textiles. I don't know whether that's something that people share. Or at least there's a preoccupation in the United States now with those domestic pressures. We also have a super child, from the super child who's, well, I need to put it, he's a lame duck now, the night of the 1st September changeover, and the assessment is that because of the position he finds himself in, why should he push the agenda and risk the anger of developing countries at this juncture. So we don't expect anything from him. There's of course other little bits of drama that have been happening on the side. Of course, the New Zealand Agriculture Chair decided to stand as a candidate for the opposition, and so this didn't endear him to his own government. But he will remain in position until this month. That's as much as he will need. On personnel, we think that could be a factor as well, because when Lamy comes in, he will have his new team of DDGs, and we expect it to be a strong team. Singapore didn't support Lamy's candidature, supported the Uruguayan candidate instead, but that was simply because we weren't asked. We basically responded to the first person who asked us. That's a simple explanation, and what we said to Lamy was, if Carlos steps down before the end of the race, then we'll support you. But then of course we stayed to the end of the race, and of course on the Latin American side, Brazil had put across a spoiler, so the Latin Americans were divided, and there was this Mauritian candidate who had support from the Caribbean countries. Now, what's happening in terms of meetings and moving things along? Well, there are now a series of informal ministerials at the margins of Davos and OECD meetings. formal starts tomorrow in Dalian. So there'll be 30 odd ministers in Dalian who meet tomorrow and the day after. And this is expected to be the last informal before Hong Kong in December. So there are some other countries that are talking about hosting informal themselves, but nothing concrete has come out of that. We are particularly unhappy about a meeting that was called in Devon very recently, where the EU called what they called a limited senior officials meeting, a limited SOM. The 10 countries were present, the old Quad countries, Canada, EU, Japan, and the United States, Brazil, India, New Zealand, because they chair agriculture, Malaysia, and Zambia, spokesman for the lesser developed countries. We're not unhappy simply because we weren't invited. We were unhappy because of what we hear happened in that meeting. The intention there in Devon was to discuss non-agricultural market access, the NAMA issues, agriculture and rules, with a focus on NAMA and on agriculture. The feedback from this meeting is that the EU has backtracked on market access for NAMA, for agriculture, and also competition and domestic support. Not much movement for market access. For us, our concern is the parallel impact this would have on NAMA issues, which is what we're interested in, because obviously we're not a major agricultural country. Nonetheless, the feedback is that we're not therefore ready for modalities and numbers by the July deadline. The Director General will give a report and a non-negotiated chairman's text. Again, we're not optimistic. Because it's a non-negotiated text, it's not going to be an ambitious text. So the question now is whether Lamy can take the momentum further than a supercharge. But everyone generally feels, all the negotiators right across the board feel that we have a commitment on paper for 2006, and this was reiterated at APEC recently. The EU has committed, of course, to eliminate export subsidies on a date to be negotiated. We don't know what that date is, but they say on a date to be negotiated. So far as domestic subsidies are concerned, there is some commitment for phase-out, but we don't think it will be ambitious for market access. And agriculture, the cost of tariffs are currently astronomical. Singapore's concern is that we should conclude by 2006 for one very important reason, because the United States President's fast track authority will expire then. So that's the pressure. Our specific interest is NAMA and services trade. We notice the European Union is pressing rules, but to be honest, a lot of my officials don't have much time for rules. They don't think it's going anywhere. And of course, there's geographical indications. The EU is pressing on geographical indications against the new world countries. And the EU is pushing, Professor Young mentioned, things like the environment at the moment. We see Japan, Mexico, and Brazil pushing for, in inverted commas, strengthening the anti-dumping rules. But we're slightly afraid. I don't know whether it's a cultural thing in Singapore that, you just don't want to take unnecessary risks. Because we're wondering whether the strengthening of anti-dumping rules will serve our exporter or importer interests. We're not quite willing to take that risk. I noticed what Professor Araf said in his presentation. But this is the sentiment on the part of my officials. They feel that we should open up AD, anti-dumping, in light of this. Because we can go backwards. We're quite happy with the jurisprudence. We think it's tight enough to discipline it. And, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So that's where we're at. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Because compared to the past 2 days conference, today I think it's more policy orientated. So we are here views from the policy angle. For the past 2 days, I thought that Professor Lin is very, very, very much like a professor of law, only talk about a legal issue, very technical one. But today, he also shared with us some policy view. I think provide a different angle to see those issues, and hopefully can attract more dialogue from our audience. So should we, any question for Professor Lin, or should we continue? Because I don't want this to be a kind of lecture and Q&A, so such kind of formal way. I believe our panelists definitely welcome any interruption during their talk. So any question to Professor Lin? Well, probably they haven't got really warm up. So if that's the case, should we just continue?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Unlike Professor Lin, I have not prepared any paper.
You don't need to.
So I'm going to have to talk about anything out of my head. Now, before I talk, mention this. Last night, Professor Yang, Professor Law of the Taiwan National University, invited us all to a very nice Taiwanese cuisine restaurant, and there we got two bottles of liquor called Guimen, the Korean liquor with the 58 the proof. It's very strong, but it's very good. So we had enough of that. There was no time to prepare for the I'm saying this not only for the excuse but also for my appreciation to Professor Yang. Now, Professor Yang suggested a couple of topics, and one of those was ministerial, and that's been covered by Professor Lin in excellent way. And so I think I'm going to discuss a couple of the topics out of four topics suggested by Professor Yang. One is this assessment. Now, it seems to me that as far as reform proposal is concerned, there are some needs to reform, but basically this assessment process is doing okay. The Sutherland report that was published last year said that the best policy is to do no harm to the system. So this means that generally it's going okay, and so don't change drastically. Whatever changes that may be necessary are some of the minor changes, I think. With just the premise, let me just mention a few things. One is the remand power of the appellate body. Are we going to need it? As you probably know, the precedent understanding says that the appellate body can uphold, modify, or reverse panel's rulings. There is no word remand in it. So is it necessary? Well, probably necessary. But my feeling is, if it's so urgent a matter, it probably is not that urgent a matter. The remand requires the standing panel, seems to me. Because right now, suppose you amend the ESU and put in a remand power. So a very body is going to remand. To whom? So this is a question. To the original panel, that the panel is gone already. And often panels can be reconvened, but there is no institutional guarantee. And so I think when you talk about the remand aspect, you need to take that part into consideration also. Now, second aspect that I may like to talk a little bit about is you've got the appellate body, and the appellate body is the ruling adopted by the district segment of the body by a rigorous consensus. And so there is automaticity. So this means that everybody has the final word. If everybody makes a mistake, what is going to happen? Nothing is going to happen. So this is a problem. So I think in every institution, you need some kind of checks and balances. In national government, you always have some sort of checks and balances, and for I think that is true with the justice of this two segments of politics also. And so the one question is how we're going to incorporate some of the checks and balances element in it. The one suggestion made by the Sutton report is to create some sort of group of experts who take up some of the important decisions of the federal body and criticize some of those decisions. So the idea is not to overrule the federal body rulings, but to just to criticize and make the federal body member aware that there are those problems. And so this is a soft approach. The other way is to use power of the general counsel to adopt the exclusive interpretation of the WTO agreement. It's already there, but that has not been equal. So the one idea is to use the power to interpret a little bit more. So for example, in things like amicus curiae issue, many countries objected. Well, then I just wonder why did they not use that power? But in any event, there are those two ways to deal with it. And so I think is one of the issues of this segment of understanding. Now, generally speaking, developing countries are having some problem with the segment of the process because of the lack of resources, the lack of time and so forth. Maybe Taiwan is not the in many developing countries, you have a lack of resources and so on. So that's a very serious problem. So how are we going to deal with it? So capacity building? Capacity building is all right. I have engaged in a number of capacity building activities. I have a little bit of doubt about how effective that is. So you go to a country, and some people come to listen to whatever you say. So you talk about anti-dumping, whatever. For a couple of hours. That's all. After 1 month, I think that many people just forget about it. And so it's not a very effective way to deal with capacity. And so probably they need to establish something like WTO center or center for the international economic or something like this institute. And institutionalize the capacity building. So this, I think, is very important issue. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the non-traditional areas. That includes many things, like environment, actually, this is by Professor Yang, food safety, culture, labor, and so forth and so on. And it's a very difficult issue, so I cannot discuss all of those, and I cannot come up with any kind of conclusion or anything. I can just talk about some problems. Now, technically, this may be a problem of conflict or inconsistency between the WTO agreement and other agreements, like Cartagena Protocol, that's under the United Nations Biodiversity Convention, or the Kyoto Protocol, which is under the United Nations Climate Change Convention. So because the principles involved there are quite different from those incorporated in the WTO. So in the WTO, the basic principle is free trade. And so there is a heavy, I wouldn't say bias, but inclination toward the free trade. But in the biodiversity and the climatic change and so forth, basic emphasis is not there. And so naturally you have some sort of incompatibility between those two sets of international conventions. So how to deal with this type of international difference between different kind of international So right now there's one case pending at the WTO on GMO, but it's not been resolved yet. And so right now the arguments back and forth are a little bit but in abstract. I think if you have real clash between those two, then they may have to think about it in more detail and in a more concrete term. So I don't know how to answer this question, but I realize that it's very important. So for example, in the Kyoto Protocol area, this is essentially to put the ceiling on the emission of carbon dioxide by signature countries. In Japan, we have to reduce the carbon dioxide emission by 6% on the basis of the figure in 1990. But since 1990 to today, there's an increase of carbon dioxide. So if you compare this, the figure today, it will be about 13% reduction. It's a very large amount. So we will have to accomplish it in some way. So probably de-emphasize in some economic sector or some programs and so on. So in Japan's biggest sources of the emission are from a household. So this is one of the biggest. The other one is the transportation, those two. So in transportation, we probably have to de-emphasize diesel trucks and so forth. And the emphasize the natural gas run trucks and so forth. But there will be some different treatment between one product and another. So we have to do something to encourage the natural gas and discourage probably the coal and the oil and so forth and so on. And then the mineral stuff are being imported from different countries. Well, so there will be some problem of the MFN, and there may be some problems about the level. So the question is, how are we going to justify those? Or can those be justified? Well, we could say, but they are not going to be justified. We have to look into it. But how are we going to justify those? So this is type of thing. Now, before I finish, let me just mention one systemic issue of the WTO. This is not the immediate problem, I don't think, but this probably will be of some importance in the future. This is the cooperative relationship between WTO and other international organizations. There are many of the international organizations like IMF, World Bank, and also WIPO, ILO, and so on. And when you talk about the non-trade issues, the roles of those organizations are very important. So cooperative relationship will be very important. So I think it's useful to think about what should be the relationship between WTO and some of those international organizations. Now, I just wanted to mention just one aspect of it. So this is IMF. Now, what I have in mind is this. Now, when ministerial conference progresses, and then if it achieves something, then this means a more liberalization of trade. Well, this probably means that in developing countries, there will be more interest. And then there will be some problem in balance of payments. Then I think it's very necessary that somebody is going to take care of that balance of payments issue. IMF can play some role in it by giving some assistance to the developing country that has some sort of financial problem due to leverage. So in that way, this is there will be a cooperative relationship between WTO and IMF. And so this is just one of those examples, but there are many examples of this nature. So for example, between WIPO and WTO, there can be a perfect relationship. Delightful agreements like a Berne Convention and Paris Convention are incorporated into WTO by reference. And well, this type of relationship is good, both for LIPO and for WTO. But it's good for LIPO because LIPO doesn't have any enforcement mechanism. It's good for WTO because the scope of application has been widened because of incorporation. Well, so this is one type of corporate relationship. But at the same time, I think it's important to think about what should be the relationship between LIPO and WTO. The WTO is an enforcement agency, basically. And so it has a strong enforcement power. But by that, there is some limit to what it can extend. And you know, if you cannot extend too much if you have very strong enforcement power. In WIPO, you don't have the enforcement power. But that, in a way, may be the strength of WIPO. It can have also lots of other things that WTO cannot have. And so those two, the international organizations, can have complementary relationship with each other. So this is just one of the examples, but there are many other examples of this nature. Well, there are many problems in the areas like RTA, but I think I have spoken over too much, so I think I'm going to stop here and let some people discuss RTA and some of some of the problems.
Thank you. I think Professor Art is probably subject to the disadvantage because they just pick up the issue they want. And anyway, before we invite Professor Art to continue, I think any questions or comments for the issues and problems identified by Professor Matsushita? Yes, Professor Lin.
Thank you, Professor Yang, for inviting to organize such a good meeting. I'm questioning to, this question should have been pointed to Professor Xu or Professor Matsushita during the yesterday morning discussion about the trade related issue, trade environment, or especially, I think it's quite relevant to dispute settlement. Because during the past few years, as mentioned, as a member, you participated in many trade-related disputes. And it seems to me the WTO jurisprudence has, to some extent, has solved some of the problem about the trade environment or trade-related issues. But my question is, seems to me the normally based on case by case basis. The new thing is, can you elaborate more about what the feasibility to establish more concrete rules, how to deal with that, especially regarding what's the range of the WTO law, what's the source of WTO law? If you look at the Shun case, they quite willing to refer to all, let me say, apply to other NEA treaties. But regarding formal case, it seems to be unwilling or very hesitant to embrace like the precautionary principle. So it seems to me, the new thing is WTC settlement should organize, should formulate more concrete rules regarding what's the source of law, what's the source of WTO rules. When you face the dispute, apart from the cover agreement, WTO cover agreement, can to what extent WTO judicial body can apply the other rules? Is any standard or any rules regarding the source of law dealing with this case? That's my question.
Thank you very much. In fact, it's too difficult a question for me to answer. But I want to make a few comments. WTO has been dealing with the environmental issue so far as that of Article 20G and sometimes B. there's nothing else. When the article Spinney was drafted, there was no evaluation. Well, there may have been, but there was no awareness of it. And so, essentially, we are dealing with environmental issues with not sufficient, the instrument. So, so we have to realize that this is what the situation is. So in the long run, there may be some need for the new agreement or change of the existing agreement and so on. But as you can see in Doha, the declaration, it says that there will be negotiations, but the rights and obligations will not be affected. Well, what are we going to negotiate? So this is a basic problem. So Doha, declaration of that aspect is concerned, is saying that we will negotiate, but we will not change. Well, then what are we going to accomplish? So right now, I think what we can do, as far as this settlement aspect is concerned, is to come up with some sort of a general guidelines of interpretation. So this is something that our ministerial conference can adopt, or the even the general council can come up with some kind of guidelines, not binding, but the guidelines on interpretation. In other words, what I'm thinking about is, so take a precautionary principle, for example, of campaign protocol, whatever. We scholars argue the issues back and forth in abstract. We take extreme cases and say that those two are in conflict. What are we going to do and so on? But I wonder if this is the way the problems really occur in actuality. So, for example, if the European community invoke the ban on the GMO or something on the precautionary principle, it may be that the imposition of ban is based on some evidence, but not sufficient. If you have a precautionary principle, you can probably invoke the ban without any evidence. But usually, I think there are some pieces like this, but not sufficient. So this is not the difference in kind, but difference in degree. And there, I think you may have some room for compromise. And so if it is no evidence and 100% evidence, well, there's no compromise. But if it is a matter of how much is necessary, well, then there may be some rooms to negotiate. And even the dispute settlement body may be able to come up with some sort of middle ground approach. So this is a very general idea, about 2 or 3 years ago, there was a task force in Japan which dealt with the environmental issue, and I participated in it. And we came up with three types of proposals to resolve the conflict. One is the waiver. It's one of the options, I think. The other one is amendment. But amendment is probably too difficult. Then the third one is general guidelines. It's not a 100% solution, and you don't resolve every issue, every dispute, but you probably can resolve maybe 50% of issues that arise. So this is probably as much as we can accomplish under the existing agreement. I'm not so sure if I am answering your question or not, but I'm just telling you my general feeling about the study.
For starters, Professor Ma Zhixin have already pointed out several of the key issues in this debate. I can only provide my personal views on this. For starters, I think the DSU explicitly stated that the Pedagogian panel should use the coverage agreement as the source of their ruling. And also one of the provisions in the DSU is that you should not add or diminish the existing rights of the WTO members. So I remember, Professor Nishu, remember very clearly that in the CTE special session negotiations on 31.1, EC put forward a proposal by the principle of global governance. And within that proposal, EC used the gasoline case, because within the gasoline case, I remember one of the sentences that was written is that WTO is not in clinical isolation from other public international law area. And EC extrapolate from the principle to state to say that maybe to implicate maybe the obligations from public international law, including those contained in MEAs, should have some status under the WTO regime. And I remember we jointly drew up a position for our government to reject that kind of interpretation, because we regard that the clinical isolation provision of the phrase that EC draw was actually quite arbitrary, because that was stated in the context of DSU when I think it was DSU Article 1 of 3, Article 3, when it stated that the appellant body can interpret the terms of the WTO agreement using the method of interpretation employed by the Vienna Convention on the Law of the Treaty, rather than using the source of public international law or laws apart from the WTO. And also within the academic debate, there has been a lot of discussion to discuss whether WTO is a so-called self-contained regime where no other legal rules will be able to penetrate the WTO legal regime. And I think it is still an academic debate and exercise. I think Professor Matsushita pointed out a very important aspect, is that unless there is a big dispute, or it doesn't have to involve big countries, but for example, Taiwan is not a contracting party to many of the international environmental agreements, and therefore if certain MEAs adopted trade measures against non-parties, then Taiwan will probably be the only or one of the few non-parties that will be used against by such trade measures. For example, if one day Taiwan was in, the government decided that we're sick and tired of being targeted by certain environmental agreements, and then we decided to sue whoever who attacked us with trade measures in front of the WTO, if such case actually surfaced in the panel or in front of the panel, then this the panel will have to deal with the problems of conflicting rules between MEAs and WTO. But before that dispute really comes out, I don't really see any solutions will be able to be crafted, because Professor, you understand it very perfectly that within the Doha negotiations on relationship between WTO and MEAs, it is going nowhere because the positions have been varied. And a lot of the position held by the WTO members is that, well, there has been no dispute. It means that the two systems are working very well. But Professor Ni held a very correct position, is that no dispute doesn't mean no conflict. But probably there are more other urgent issues in the mind of the WTO member that they want to push aside such issues when no real conflict exists. That will be my brief comment.
Just an immediate response to what Professor Matsushita and Professor Xu just said. I'm glad that Professor Xu brought up the statement of the appellate body in the U.S. Gasman case, in which it says that the WTO law should not be read in clinical isolation with the general principles of the international law. But the question then becomes, what are the general principles of international law? How do you draw the line? Where are the boundaries? And we are not here that so far in the appellate body, we don't have somebody with a head full of crazy ideas about the public international law. But if we do have somebody in there, and one prominent example I would give is Professor Ernest Woody Petersman, who's a good friend of mine, but anybody in the WTO circle would know his strong views on the linkage between trade and human rights. And if he one day became a party board member, he would, I'm sure, bring try at least to
bring human rights in through the back door to the WTO piggybacking on this statement by the appellate body that some human rights principles are general principles of international law. So I think that's a big question for us to ponder on. And also a comment on Professor Matsushita's suggestion about having the WTO General Council drafting some general principles of interpretation in WTO cases, or what are the sources that you could resort to in interpretation. I'm not sure that's a good idea. I mean, if you look at the judicial tribunals of any other countries in the world or any other international tribunals, none of them have any such rules of interpretation drawn up by the legislative arm of that government or that international institution. I mean, it's inevitable that if you have a judicial organ, you will have to trust them to do some gap-filling work. You will have to trust them to read between the lines. I mean, that's the responsibility of the judicial organ. Either you do not have the judicial organ and you do it all by yourself, so which means that you have to draw up a law for every minor case that might happen tomorrow. Or you have a judicial organ and you trust them that they can utilize some basic principles of interpretation according to their knowledge, and they can do a case-by-case analysis of each individual case. But I don't think it's good for you to draw up a line of interpretation, because again, if you bring this issue up in the WTO, this would become another battleground for the different countries to decide on which agreements, which international regimes to be put in, whether you should put in environmental treaties, or you should put in human rights treaties, or you should put in some other crazy international treaties, which might even endanger the WTO system, just like Professor Young said at the beginning. So, I mean, those are just my personal reviews. I'm trying to be as provocative as possible. So I hope Professor Matsushita can bear with me and can have some dialogue.
I think there's a basic assumption, I think, that Professor Matsushita and Professor Gao and Professor Shi are making. I'm going to try and make things a little bit more complicated. I think the assumption here is that the problem has to do with what law or whose law should apply. But I want to explain myself before I say more. I am one of those crazy people. I am a public international lawyer. I come to trade law as a public international lawyer. And you know, if I think about it as a litigator, what I see happening today in the industry is this. If I am going to have a dispute with another country, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a list of tribunals I can sue that country in. And I'm going to go for the tribunal I can win in, depending on the issue. And so the most important question to me is not which law apply or the law of which organization. The most important thing to me is which forum is the most friendly to my case. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do what a conflicts lawyer does, a private international lawyer. I'm going to go forum shopping. Now, when I go forum shopping, certain distinctive patterns will emerge. We've gone through this in recent years in Singapore. We've been in very many forums. And every time, it's the same consideration. Where are we going to win it? And it's going to come down to who are the judges sitting there? How do they think? Who is going to be the chairman of the tribunal? Where is he leaning? Is this the kind of case we want judges who are sympathetic to developing countries to hear? Or is this the kind of case we want judges who are sympathetic to developed countries to hear, depending on what the issue is? This is going to cause the opposite problem from what I think Professor Matsushita, Professor Shi, and Professor Gao are talking about. This is going to cause the tribunals to compete for work, because they're like supermarkets. You don't go and buy their fish, they don't sell any fish. That's one possibility.
Yes, as a public international lawyer, you are thinking 100% correct. But I think you also want to know that which foreign is not only most friendly to you, but the award most effective to your case. And about the competitor for the case, I don't think, probably Manchita, Professor Manchita can correct me, I don't think the DC settlement body or the appellate body or the panel are competing any case with the other foreign. I think for the issue that's raised, I think they don't care whether those cases are coming to them. If the case doesn't come to WTO dispute settlement body, appellate body, I think they feel quite happy. They don't need those kind of work law. So the kind of competing for case and the tribunal competing for case, the problem is quite correct in domestic court. But whether it's so correct in the WTO competing case with some other tribunal, I have some reservations. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make a short comment. In response to Professor Gao's comments, two things. One is I just wonder if the panels on the bodies are really judicial order. So this is one of the questions. It's not a political order, but is that a full-fledged judicial order? So this is one of my questions. Now, it seems to me that panels and appellate body, or the dispute settlement body, is somewhere between political decision making and the judiciary. Panels and appellate body are technically sort of like an auxiliary organs to DSB. So they come up with legal decisions, but those will have to be adopted by the dispute settlement body. There again, you have automaticity, so those rulings will be adopted. But still, it's not the panels on a fair body, or it's not a fair body, which is decided. The decision de facto is made by a fair body, but it has to be adopted. So this is the compromise, I think, when our institution was constructed. So the members wanted to have a control over the decision. Settlement process, but they don't want to repeat what have happened in the past yet. So compromise is we have a part of control, but automaticity. So it's the system type of thing. So this is one of the two things I just wanted to mention. The other thing is this: when I talk about some principles of interpretation, I'm not suggesting you come up with the general rules of conflict of law. what I'm talking about is much narrower scope, mostly about evidentiary aspect. There was a question about the precautionary principle, how to deal with it. And in fact, those problems will occur in the district settlement. So my sense is that in many cases it is not the matter of no evidence or 100% evidence. Probably in many cases the matter is how much evidence, how much is sufficient. So I think within that narrow scope there can be some kind of rules of rules of, well, maybe not the rules but just the guidelines or some sort of suggestions to follow for the panels and everybody to adopt.
Thank you very much, Professor Masuda. I think I totally agree with your answer. Now, I'm going to comment on the statement made by Professor Lin, and again, I'll try to be provocative. I think I agree with you that it's very important for you to choose a winning form, a form in which you can win your case. But another important consideration, I think this is probably more important, is that after you win the case, you can implement the ruling. And if you look at the situation so far, the WTO has inevitably become the forum of choice
for any dispute in which you can have any trade-related aspects for those kind of cases. Actually, this has happened in NAFTA, even in trade forums. If you look at NAFTA, there have been several cases that have been brought both before the NAFTA arbitration panels and also before the WTO panels. And later on, people would inevitably decide to go to the WTO, because in the WTO, first of all, you can implement your case, because otherwise you can't retaliate if the other party, the losing party, doesn't implement the ruling. And second, the WTO is a global or almost a global forum. In the WTO, even though there are no so-called presidential rulings, and in theory at least the rulings are supposed to be binding only among the parties concerned, so the other 146 countries which are not in the dispute might not be affected by the ruling. But in practice, actually it has, it will have systematic implications. So if you win a case against the United States in the WTO, you are not just winning a case against one country. You are winning a case against all the other 147 countries in the WTO. So again is an important consideration, because by paying the same amount of money to the lawyers, now instead of winning one case, you are winning 147 cases. So that also contributes to the preference of a party to choose the WTO over other international forums. Thanks.
I think that's one of the things
I'd
like to respond
to. Just very quickly. Just a bit of background. I have been known to be slightly unfriendly to the WTO dispute settlement system. One article I wrote elicited some comments, and an article I wrote in 2002 in the Singapore Journal of International Comparative Law and Law and Diplomacy in World Trade Disputes. My view of it is that, WTO specialists have an easy time convincing themselves about how successful the WTO dispute settlement system is. But when I consult people across the board, that opinion is not as strong. And there are several reasons at several levels for that. The trade retaliation point is something which I think is a huge weakness in the WTO system. I sometimes, in order to demonstrate the point to my own students, I say, we have a problem with the supply of water from Malaysia. I say, so let's say we have a trade dispute in Malaysia. What are we going to do? Slap tariffs on water? Because we're small, we're tiny in that ultimate scenario. Okay, and that's one weakness in the system. In terms of arbitral awards, because of the New York Convention, we find that 99.99% of arbitral awards are honored, because many of the countries that we have deep relations with, industrialized countries, actually do rely on their reputation in that regard. And if you look at a forum like the International Court of Justice, even at the International Court of Justice, the last 10, 15 years, you don't see anybody ignoring awards. The only real problem is the Nigeria-Cameroon case, because Nigeria has problems with implementation. I also see, as a public international lawyer, how judicial behavior gets caught up with bloc politics globally. Again, to take the example of the ICJ, initially it was believed that the ICJ favored developed countries, until 1984, in a case called the Nicaragua case. Then it was believed that it favored developing countries. In the two phases, first you had the developed countries all going to the ICJ, the developing countries didn't want to go there. Then you had the developing countries going to the ICJ, the developed countries don't want to go there. If this could happen with the WTO, when you look across the board, across the world, the users of the WTO dispute settlement system are not evenly spread across the world. And it's still relatively early days. People are watching the jurisprudence coming up. They're making up their own mind about how the WTO dispute settlement system is functioning from their point of view. And the final thing I think is this, and I have been personally and practically responsible for advocating this viewpoint in Singapore. We want to sign FTAs with our closest trading partners. When it comes to any issue to do with trade which is of any importance to us, the WTO is completely and We have our own dispute settlement system in each of our SDAs. And that seems to be where we're going. At the end of the day, though, we have a choice. Yeah, but the deeper cuts, the deeper liberalization will be found in our SDAs.
Thank you very much.
Could you just keep your comment short? Yes, because I definitely would like to give Professor Araki the opportunity.
All right, just some brief response to Professor Lin. First, the question of retaliation. As I mentioned yesterday, you know, you can definitely choose some products which are of crucial importance to your trade partners so as to make them comply. For example, in the case of the United States, you can choose Harley-Davidson motorcycles from Wisconsin, you know, textiles from Cabanas, and oranges from Florida, because those are politically sensitive states. And second issue is the issue of whether the WTO is more effective or the other international fora are more effective. You mentioned the RCG. I think RCG exactly illustrates my point rather than your point, because with the RCG there is a self-selection mechanism. If you want to bring a case to the RCG, both parties have to agree to the jurisdiction of the RCG, right? So, I mean, if they agree to the jurisdiction, they already think that they will comply to the decision. If you are not going to comply with the ruling, you just don't agree to the jurisdiction. So there's already this self-selection mechanism working. So, but with the WTO, the thing is different. Even if you are very reluctant, you can still be dragged before the WTO panel as head of body. And third thing with the FTA. Actually, I'm not sure I get the same kind of evidence as you do, because if you look at NAFTA, which is one of the most notable examples of FTA, most of the disputes between the United States and Canada and Mexico are actually handled in the WTO rather than in NAFTA, even though NAFTA also has the dispute settlement system. I think if Singapore later on decides to jump on the FTA bandwagon, you will see the same phenomenon. Because you will definitely find that the WTO is more effective. At least, I mean, those people who work in trade circles, just like me, just a narrow-minded trade specialist, and they will, I think they will have this kind of perspective. Thank you.
And I think we should give the floor to Professor Araki.
All right. Well, let me start with another frivolous comment on what Professor Gao mentioned about the ability. Billy Peterson, don't worry about that. Because I can be 100% sure that he will never be selected as the appellate body member from the European community. Actually, his name was mentioned as the first member of the other body from Europe. So he was actually competing with Ellerman. But initial name, Ellerman wasn't initially named. I think, as far as I know, two names are mentioned from Germany, Petersmann and Meinhard Helf. And the member government of the European community didn't like these candidates, so they were out. And particularly because people like academics like Peterson, who have written extensively on WTO, I think they are screened out of the candidature at the very early stage. I think, as far as I understand it, the practice is that they would like to select somebody as neutral as possible. They want to have a tabula rasa. Rather than a very well experienced trade experts, and to ensure that their neutrality. You may have read this strange article by Professor Steinberg in the American Journal of International Law, where the United States is actually privately interviewing all those candidates for the other body. And I checked this with Professor Panucci. And he said, "Oh yes, I was interviewed by somebody at with the USTL." So, okay, so you can be sure that Peterson will never be selected as a board member. Anyway,
as the appointee, as the panel.
Yes, Paris is a different story. Yeah, because Paris is selected on the basis of agreement between the government. So the member government lacking, and if they regard him as a neutral person, no, that's fine. I mean, but the upper body is a different story, I think. Well, according to Professor Yan's initial list, I am supposed to talk about RTA. I feel a bit awkward about it because, for one thing, some of you who have participated in the session at the National Public University, you have heard a very eloquent speech by the Ambassador Yan. And he was very his position was very, very clear. He was citing this Sutherland report, and he was talking about this erosion of non-discrimination. He was in favor of doubling. He was cautious about this spread of RTA, etc., etc. Yeah, and as an academic, I feel very sympathetic to him, his position. But also, I'm still a bit of a practitioner, and I am on this board of experts who are in charge of making a recommendation on the feasibility study of East Asian Petrate area. So in that position, I cannot take this very critical position of the spread of the RTA, so I don't know what to say. But maybe just very small comment on the root cause of what is happening today. We discussed it with Professor Lim at breakfast today, actually. What is happening today, the origin of this proliferation of regional trade agreements in the world, I think, can be traced back to 1984. That is a year when U.S. Congress enacted the Trade Act of 1984. This was, of course, in preparation for the imminent multilateral round at the GATT, which later to be named as the Rio Round. But for that purpose, Congress had to extend the fast-track authority of the president to negotiate trade agreements. But in that particular legislation, they specify that this authority is granted to the president not only for multilateral negotiations at the GATT, but also for bilateral trade agreements concluded between the United States and its trading partners. And you know the rest of the story. This authority was materialized in the form of U.S.-Israel FTA, which was concluded in 1985 or 86, something like that, just before the initiation of the Canada-U.S. FTA negotiations. But this was just a tiny stream, but then eventually this tiny stream became a huge river, and this is a point of departure for the U.S. trade policy. Up until that time, U.S. was very much critical of regional trade agreements, and all the previous rounds, the Dillon round, Kennedy round, Tokyo round, you could say that one major factor for the United States to initiate those trade rounds was the expansion of the European communities. The U.S. was very much critical of this regional approach. It was it didn't like the so-called fortress Europe, and so to maintain the integrity of their position, I think U.S. Maintained this multilateralist policy. After all, this multilateral—the origin of multilateralism was the United States, wasn't it? I mean, the current U.S. policy of multilateral trading system probably originated in the Atlantic Charter of 1941, and this was the work of Colville Hull, and multilateralism, in a way, was the U.S. invention, but it was the United States itself that departed from that tradition in 1984, and so, U.S. cannot, as I say, criticize the status quo. They started all over. Well, and with that, I don't know. Maybe I could try to give a few footnotes to Professor Lim's excellent presentation for the ongoing round. To be frank, very frankly, I'm in no position to talk about the current round. I was a trade negotiator with the Japanese government, but that was up until 2001, and the summer of 2001. So I didn't even go to Doha. The only ministerial I attended under the WTO, I attended the failed Brussels meeting in 1990, but under the WTO, the only ministerial I attended was Geneva. I was still with the WTO secretary, so I couldn't say I attended it. I just observed it from a secretarial viewpoint. So the only one was the Seattle meeting in 1999. So I'm not an old man. I can't really tell you what is going on today, but from their vantage point, I can say something about the endgame scenario. Nobody is talking about the endgame scenario. Assuming that everything goes well and there's a substantive conclusion of the negotiations in 2006, what's next? Then that lawyer's job to wrap it up. As you may know, to the end of the Uruguay round, when the negotiations were concluded substantively in December 1993, and there was an intervening period from that point until the Marrakesh ministerial in April 1994. And during this period, so-called the legal drafting group was working really, really seriously. This was the lawyer's job to finalize and to make it give the substance a legal form. Was the lawyer's job. And so, as many of you lawyers, and probably you may be interested in how the whole game is going to end in the Doha round. And I don't know how frankly speaking, I just don't know. Well, one thing I can tell you is that there are two areas where one area where implementation would be very difficult, and the other area where implementation would be relatively easy. And the area where implementation would be very difficult would be the area where the amendment of the agreement would be involved. So Professor Lin was discussing this issue of rulemaking. If there's going to be a change in the anti-dumping rules, then that would certainly involve amendment to the agreement. And then there's all complicated procedure you have to go through under the article, was it 9 or 10? 10. 10 of the, was it 9? 9. 9 of the agreement establishing the World Trade Organization. And so that's going to be a very complicated process. But actually, if you look at the area where negotiations are going on now, that's only a tiny fraction of the actual agenda. So if you're talking about agriculture, non-agriculture market access or services, you have a mechanism, you have a built-in mechanism to change the substance of each member's commitment without going through the formal amendment procedure. Right, the technique used to to change the actual substance of each member's commitment is known as protocol. Okay, so this is the GATT tradition. Whenever trade negotiating round was concluded under the GATT, there would be a protocol, a tariff protocol, supersede the old schedule. This could be a de facto amendment of the GATT, but because a schedule is supposed to be the integral part of the GATT. But actually, they didn't have to go through the amendment procedure. So the same technique can be easily applied to the GATT schedule if you're talking about NAMA, non-agriculture market access. The same can be applied to services, and we do have a precedent on this. As you may be aware, there was a financial services negotiation and telecommunication negotiation under the auspices of the WTO, and the resulting in order to incorporate the result of these negotiations, the protocol technique was adopted. So there was fourth protocol and fifth protocol on the GATT, and there was a new commitment, and the new commitment under the protocol superseded the older commitment under the Uruguay one for those parties who subscribed to the new protocol. Of course, the protocol, the membership of protocol is limited. This is a kind of plurilateral agreement. Not all the 148 members of the WTO subscribe to those telecom protocol or financial services protocol, about 60 countries, I think. So they have already in services there's a precedent. So if you have the sixth protocol on the GATT, and if you have a new schedule attached to it, then that doesn't prove. Agriculture, you may think that there's a problem. Yeah, probably there's a problem, because that may it would involve the amendment to the agreement on agriculture. But I don't know. If there's somebody innovative, there's an innovative thinker, there could be a way to incorporate the new rules of agriculture into each country's specific tariff schedule, because after all, we're talking about modalities, right? The modality, where do you find modalities for reduction of tariffs or domestic support or export subsidy commitment? You don't find it in the agreement on agriculture. Yes, agreement on agriculture, for example, Article 4 speaks about the general principle of tariffication, but it doesn't mention anything about figures. All the figures are actually contained in each country's specific schedule. Okay, so in order to regulate or harmonize the ratio of reduction, there was a modalities paper adopted in Uruguay, but this is non-paper. It is very difficult to find the actual document. I mean, you can find it somewhere on the WTO website, I'm sure. But as far as I know, it doesn't even have an official document number. It's a job document, and so this was a kind of informal agreement amongst the participants of the Uruguay round, and they abided by this informal agreement, and there was a process of verification, each participant of the Uruguay had a chance to verify that nobody was cheating on their commitment. But the document itself was a non-paper. So when you're talking about the figures, that same technique can be applied. I mean, you don't have to amend the agreement on agriculture to come up with the specific modalities for reduction on agriculture protection. The problem is other areas. How do you make new rules on the level of let's say the export competition? Wouldn't that amount to some change in the substantive rules the agreement on agriculture? How do you deal with what is called peace clause? If you want to extend the peace clause again, don't you have to amend? Well, but I don't know. Maybe the one technique that could be applied in that aspect would be a kind of reference paper, which is adopted in the telecom protocol. Again, a reference paper itself is a known paper, but each member who has subscribed to first become party to the telecoms protocol has actually accepted it, and it has incorporated into its country's specific schedule of all of these rules relating to the regulation of the telecom sector. So that sort of technique can be applied to the agricultural sector, and so this could be a fairly easily achieved. And for other matters, maybe there's a consensus decision among the W members could suffice, and you don't have to really go through the amendment procedure. So that means that if you're really thinking about endgame scenario, probably you can. At the very end of the process, and if the ministers have reached that there's nothing can be done but the change of rules, then they have a way out. They can do something by tinkering with their country-specific commitments, and with this you can achieve quite significant reduction in the level of trade protection among all the two members. Okay, I think I have spoken too much. We are only 12 minutes left. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, but I still have a little bit of reservation whether it's really, really we can skip the kind of process. I know that the schedule can save some kind of, you know, the amendment, you know, hassle, because when you talk about the commitment, I think you talk about those multi-essence things. So I mean, it's quite easy to incorporate into the tariff schedule, service, the schedule of a specific commitment, to those kind of things. But I really wonder, like for agriculture multi-essence, yes, that we can, you know, through the back door, you know, incorporate into the schedule. But how about those rules, especially those kinds of subsidy things? I don't know whether we really can go around the amendment process. But I do believe, like, if a member is willing to, you know, to get some kind of decision to interpret the agreement, I think we also can save the trouble to amend the existing agreement. But anyway, I think this is really a big issue that a member needs to think of it. I don't know what a member needs to think about it. Probably the secretary is going to think about it. If the members are able to reach some kind of consensus, I think it already, you know, have a great achievement. I think, and how to incorporate into the current agreement probably will be left to the secretary. But Professor Ling, I think you have some comments.
This is just a knee-jerk reaction and more to reflect on Professor Raki's excellent points. Again, I'll use an example I know. A lot of my colleagues, including myself, when we were doing FTA negotiations, we suffered from one problem. We cut our teeth. We learned to be treaty negotiators as air services negotiators. Because, of course, if you think about Singapore, our most successful company, SIA, so a lot of government international lawyers spend a lot of time negotiating air routes. And you know, air services negotiations, it really takes the initiator. It's a temple with very many steps. Just trying to understand one air service negotiation can take a long time. Why? Because air services negotiations are not done by formal treaties. In the sense that when you look at the pieces of paper, they don't look like treaty documents. There is a very simple reason why that has always been so with air lawyers. It is because of confidentiality. So over time, public international lawyers develop a love, a passion, even a perverse obsession with a memoranda of understanding, right? And these are wonderful inter-agency papers. I put the paper you gave me in my file. You put the paper I gave you in your file, we know what's going on there. We carry this mentality into our FTA.
if you look at our FDA website, look at the
US FDA, for example,
it has a whole list of letters.
Dear Tommy, dear Ambassador Zarek, you know, all these letters are there.
And it's because when we were negotiating these things, we were asking ourselves some really tough questions. How many different types of paper can you use safely? And the answer is, it's unlimited. You can call it a third-party note. My ministry sends it to you with a covering note. You know, the Foreign Ministry of the Republic of Singapore presents its compliments to you. This is what we've agreed. Or it could be a letter between two people. It even descended to the level of emails. So I would talk to my counterpart. My counterpart was my colleague in Geneva in the United Nations. We were paying off the Gulf War, so we were good friends. I pick up the phone and I say, listen, mate, I'll send you an email. We'll write it in a formal way. You keep that email and I'll keep your email. How about that? We know what this word means. So we don't have to make a big issue.
That's a trouble problem.
it's very interesting because you are really exploiting Vienna Convention, Article 31 and 32. Yeah? And there is some experience in the WTO of this, an easy computer case where they talk about legitimate expectations. Yeah, so there is some evidence that sometimes you can get the WTO to look at assorted evidence of what was intended on measures. That's just a major reaction.
Any question and comment?
Maybe can I say
something?
Sure, definitely. Well, there's one thing I forgot to tell you. Okay, as a veteran of trade negotiations, I should tell you one thing. For people of Taiwan, you may have feeling that what is going on in Geneva? This kind of roller coaster ride. I mean, you accede to the WTO in November 2001. You have a very great expectations on that. But then the negotiations go on and end up with a fiasco in Cancun. And then again, it looks like for the time being, the whole package was being saved at the official level in the formal July package in 2004. So ups and downs, and what's going on? But let me tell you, this is normal. This is nothing new in the WTO. In the Uruguay round, this was just like this. The Montreal interim review meeting was supposed to be like just like Cancun, an interim review process to regulate the whole round. It was the Uruguay round was supposed to be concluded in 4 years, and it was convened in the middle point, two years after the launching. But because of the agriculture problem, the ministers produced no declaration, nothing. But then, immediately thereafter, there was a senior officials meeting convened in Geneva, and it rescued the whole package, right? And then there was this disastrous meeting in Brussels in 1990, which was supposed to be concluding the whole process, but there was zero result out of this ministerial. This time, the rescue operation took some more time. But 1 year thereafter, there was so-called Dunkel draft. And again, this was drafted at the senior officials level. The TS chair was just as is today, Mr. Dunkel, the late Mr. Dunkel, I should say. This formed the basis of the final result of the Uruguay round. So this ups and downs, and it's a kind of usual event in the multilateral negotiations, and also the sense of crisis. I mean, everybody is trying to create mini crisis. If you read the most recent press release from the WTO, Dr. Tupachai is urging. He is very much upset about this lack of progress, and he's urging every member to do something until the end of July. Blah blah blah. Okay, again, this is, I have seen this so many times during the yoga round. So, okay, things are quite normal. I mean, you don't have to be too much worried about these ups and downs and roller coaster rides. That's a normal thing you need to be there with the multilateral trade negotiation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think, yes, as a new sitting member, you know, Taiwan has a great expectation for the WTO. Especially, we don't have, you know, much access to the international forum, and WTO is one of the, you know, forum we can have access to. So we really want this can this organization can have its function, because Taiwan is so dependent on trade. But just as you say, we know that this organization went through all this up and down. Because we file application since 1990, so we already experienced how it concluded the workaround. So we know that, you know, although members have those fight conflict, but sometimes, you know, during the crisis, they are able to manage to survive, to let this organization to survive. So hopefully, in year 2006. That members can, you know, have the sense of urgency and can, you know, try to conclude something, you know, no matter how small the achievement is, if they can, you know, reach some kind of agreement, I think that would be a good news for the whole world. And on the other hand, because we are the new member, we still need those kind of capacity building. So those kind of up and down somehow provide us the opportunity to, you know, better equip ourselves for the future negotiation. So it may not be a bad thing. The reason we feel, you know, a little bit concerned is probably not, you know, the slow progress of the appeal, but we are more concerned about the proliferation of those kind of regional trade agreements. Although our economists are kept telling us that don't worry, you know, the kind of marginalization may not happen, because take a serious look at those RTA, they are not so effective, at least for the moment. But we're still very worried, you know, as a responsible government, so we certainly don't want to be excluded from those, you know, cooperative arrangements. And so now our government tried their best to find, you know, a different type of a cooperative arrangement. It may not call it RTA, may not call it FTA, but try to have more, you know, cooperation with the other authorities in order to promote our trade, so that we can still make something done during those kind of downturn of the WTO. And I know that you know, participants may have a lot of questions, but they fully, you know, respect my instruction about the, you know, time management. They know they cannot afford for you people to lose the flight, to miss the flight. So thank you so much. Let us just thank our panelists again. Hopefully next year when we have the, you know, honor to have them in Taipei again, we can have the similar kind of panel discussion, informal one. And next time probably we have, you know, more time to prepare for that, then we have more participants and better arrangement. Thank you so much.